Part 3, Chapter 1. Sergei Ivanovich Koznishev wanted a rest from mental work, and instead of going abroad as he usually did, he went to stay in the country with his brother toward the end of May. In his judgment, the best sort of life was a country life. He had come now to enjoy such a life at his brother's. Konstantin Levin was very glad to have him, especially as he didn't expect his brother Nikolai that summer. But in spite of his affection and respect for Sergei Ivanovich, Konstantin Levin was uncomfortable with his brother in the country. It made him uncomfortable, and it positively annoyed him to see his brother's attitude toward the country. To Konstantin Levin, the country was where one spent one's life, where there were pleasures, endeavors, labor. To Sergei Ivanovich, the country meant on one hand rest from work, on the other a valuable antidote to the corrupt influences of town, which he took with satisfaction and a sense of its utility. To Konstantin Levin, the country was especially good because it afforded an opportunity for labor, of the usefulness of which there could be no doubt. To Sergei Ivanovich, the country was particularly good because there it was possible and fitting to do nothing. Moreover, Sergei Ivanovich's attitude toward the peasants rather piqued Konstantin. Sergei Ivanovich used to say that he knew and liked the peasantry, and he often talked to the peasants, which he knew how to do without affectation or condescension. And from every such conversation he would deduce general conclusions in favour of the peasantry, and in confirmation of his knowing them. Konstantin Levin didn't like such an attitude toward the peasants. To Konstantin, the peasant was simply the chief partner in their common labour, and in spite of all the respect and the love, almost like that of kinship, he had for the peasant, imbibed probably, as he said himself, with the milk of his peasant nurse, still, as their partner, while sometimes enthusiastic over the vigour, gentleness, and justice of these men, he was often, when their common labours called for other qualities, exasperated with the peasant for his carelessness, disorganisation, drunkenness, and lying. If he had been asked whether he liked or didn't like the peasants, Konstantin Levin would have been absolutely at a loss as to what to reply. He liked and didn't like the peasants, just as he liked and didn't like men in general. Of course, being a good-hearted man, he liked men more than he disliked them, and so too with the peasants. But like or dislike the common people, as something apart, he could not. Not only because he lived with them, and all his interests were bound up with theirs, but also because he regarded himself as a part of them, didn't see any special qualities or failings distinguishing himself from the common people, and could not contrast himself with them. Moreover, although he had lived so long in the closest relations with the peasants, as farmer and arbitrator, and what was more, as adviser, the peasants trusted him, and for 30 miles around they would come to ask his advice, he had no definite views of the peasantry, and would have been as much at a loss to answer the question whether he knew the common people as the question whether he liked them. For him to say he knew the peasantry would have been the same as to say he knew men. He was continually watching and getting to know people of all sorts, and among them peasants, whom he regarded as good and interesting people, and he was continually discovering new traits, altering his former views of them, and forming new ones. With Sergei Ivanovich it was quite the contrary. Just as he liked and praised a country life in comparison with the life he did not like, so too he liked the peasantry in contradistinction to the class of men he didn't like, and so too he knew the peasantry as something distinct from and opposed to men generally. In his methodical brain there were distinctly formulated certain aspects of peasant life, deduced partly from that life itself, but chiefly from contrast with other modes of life. He never changed his opinion of the peasantry and his sympathetic attitude toward them. In the discussions that arose between the brothers on their views of the peasantry, Sergei Ivanovich always got the better of his brother, precisely because Sergei Ivanovich had definite ideas about the peasant, his character, his qualities, and his tastes. Konstantin Levin had no definite and unalterable idea on the subject, and so in their arguments, Konstantin was readily convicted of contradicting himself. In Sergei Ivanovich's eyes, his younger brother was a splendid fellow, with his heart in the right place, as he expressed it in French, but with a mind which, though fairly quick, was too much influenced by the impressions of the moment, and consequently filled with contradictions. With all the condescension of an elder brother, He sometimes explained to him the true import of things, but he derived little satisfaction from arguing with him, because he got the better of him too easily. Konstantin Levin regarded his brother as a man of immense intellect and culture, noble in the highest sense of the word, and possessed of a special faculty for working for the public good. But in the depths of his heart, the older he became, and the more intimately he knew his brother, the more and more frequently the thought struck him that this faculty of working for the public good, of which he felt himself utterly devoid, was possibly not so much a quality as a lack of something. Not a lack of good, honest, noble desires and tastes, but a lack of vital force, of what is called heart, of that impulse which drives a man to choose one out of the innumerable paths of life, and to care only for that one. The better he knew his brother, the more he noticed that Sergei Ivanovitch and many other people who worked for the public welfare were not led by an impulse of the heart to care for the public good, but reasoned from intellectual considerations that it was a right thing to take interest in public affairs, and consequently took interest in them. Levin was confirmed in this generalization by observing that his brother didn't take questions affecting the public welfare or the question of the immortality of the soul any more to heart than he did chess problems or the ingenious construction of a new machine. Besides this, Konstantin Levin was not at ease with his brother, because in summer in the country, Levin was continually busy with work on the land, and the long summer day was not long enough for him to get through all he had to do, while Sergei Ivanovitch was taking a holiday. But though he was taking a holiday now, that is to say, he was doing no writing, he was so used to intellectual activity that he liked to put into concise and eloquent shape the ideas that occurred to him, and liked to have someone to listen to him. His most usual and natural listener was his brother. And so, in spite of the friendliness and directness of their relations, Konstantin felt an awkwardness in leaving him alone. Sergei Ivanovitch liked to stretch himself on the grass in the sun, and to lie there, basking and chatting lazily. "You wouldn't believe," he would say to his brother, "what a pleasure this rural laziness is to me. Not an idea in one's brain, as empty as a drum." But Konstantin Levin found it boring sitting and listening to him, especially when he knew that while he was away they would be carting manure to fields that were not ploughed and ready for it, and heap it all up anyhow, and would not screw the shares in the ploughs, but would let them come off, and then say that the new ploughs were a silly invention, and there was nothing like the old Andreevna plough, and so on. "Come, you've done enough trudging about in the heat," Sergei Ivanovitch would say to him. "No, I must just run to the office for a minute," Levin would answer, and he would run off to the fields. Chapter 2. Early in June, it happened that Agafia Mikhailovna, the old nurse and housekeeper, in carrying to the cellar a jar of mushrooms she had just pickled, slipped, fell, and sprained her wrist. The district doctor, a talkative young medical student who had just finished his studies, came to see her. He examined the wrist, said it was not broken, was delighted at the chance of talking to the celebrated Sergei Ivanovitch Koznishev, and to show his advanced views of things, he told him all the gossip of the district, complaining of the poor state into which the district council had fallen. Sergei Ivanovitch listened attentively, asked him questions, and, roused by a new listener, talked fluently, uttered a few keen and weighty observations, respectfully appreciated by the young doctor, and was soon in the eager frame of mind his brother knew so well, which inevitably followed a brilliant and eager conversation. After the departure of the doctor, he wanted to go with a fishing rod to the river. Sergei Ivanovitch was fond of angling, and was, it seemed, proud of being fond of such a stupid occupation. Konstantin Levin, whose presence was needed in the fields and the meadows, had come to take his brother in the trap. It was at that time of the year, the turning point of summer, when the crops of the present year are a certainty, when one begins to think of the sowing for next year, and the harvest is at hand, when the rye is formed, though its ears are still light, not yet full, and grey-green it waves in the wind, when the green oats, with tufts of yellow grass scattered here and there among it, droop irregularly over the late-sown fields, when the early buckwheat is already out and hiding the ground, when the fallow land, trodden hard as stone by the cattle, is half ploughed over, with paths too hard to be touched by the plough. When, from the dry manure heaps carted onto the fields, there comes at sunset a smell of manure mingled with the honeyed odour of grasses, and on the lowlands the riverside meadows are a thick sea of grass waiting for the mowing, with blackening heaps of sorrel stalks among it. It was at the time when there comes a brief pause in the toil of the fields before the beginning of the labours of the harvest, every year recurring, every year straining every nerve of the peasants. The crop was a splendid one, and the bright, hot summer days had set in with short, dewy nights. The brothers had to drive through the woods to reach the meadows. Sergei Ivanovitch was all the while admiring the beauty of the woods, which were a tangled mass of leaves, pointing out to his brother here an old lime tree on the point of flowering, dark on the shady side and brightly spotted with the yellow stipules, there the young shoots of this year's saplings, brilliant with emerald. Konstantin Levin didn't like talking and hearing about the beauty of nature. Words for him diminished the beauty of what he saw. He agreed to what his brother said, but he couldn't help beginning to think of other things. When they came out of the woods, his attention was completely engrossed by the view of the fallow land on the slope of a hill, in parts yellow with grass, in parts trampled and checkered with furrows, in parts dotted with the ridges of manure, and in parts even ploughed. A string of carts was moving across it. Levin counted the carts, and was pleased that all that were needed had been brought, and at the sight of the meadows his thoughts passed to the mowing. He always felt singularly excited at the haymaking. On reaching the meadow, Levin stopped the horse. The morning dew was still lying on the thick undergrowth of the grass, and so that he might not get his feet wet, Sergei Ivanovitch asked his brother to drive him in the trap up to the willow tree from which the carp was caught. Sorry as Konstantin Levin was to crush his grass, he drove him into the meadow. The high grass softly turned about the wheels and the horse's legs, leaving its seeds clinging to the wet axles and spokes of the wheels. His brother seated himself under a bush, arranging his tackle, while Levin led the horse away, tied him up, and walked into the vast grey-green sea of grass, unmoved by the wind. The silky grass, with its ripe seeds, came almost to his waist in the dampest spots. Crossing the meadow, Konstantin Levin came out onto the road, and met an old man with a swollen eye, carrying a beehive on his shoulder.
"What? Taken a stray swarm, Fomitch?" he asked. "No, indeed, Konstantin Mitrich. All we can do is to keep our own. This is the second swarm that has flown away. Luckily the boys caught them. They were ploughing your field. They unyoked the horses and galloped after them. Well, what do you say, Fomitch? Start mowing or wait a while?" "Oh, well, our way's to wait till St. Peter's Day, but you always mow sooner. Well, to be sure, please God, the hay's good. There'll be plenty for the beasts."
"What do you think about the weather?"
"That's in God's hands. Maybe it will be fine."
Levin went up to his brother. Sergei Ivanovitch had caught nothing, but he wasn't bored, and seemed in the most cheerful frame of mind. Levin saw that, stimulated by his conversation with the doctor, he wanted to talk. Levin, on the other hand, would have liked to get home as soon as possible to give orders about getting together the mowers for next day, and to set at rest his doubts about the mowing, which greatly absorbed him.
"Well, let's be going," he said. "Why be in such a hurry? Let's stay a little. But how wet you are! Even though one catches nothing, it's nice. That's the best thing about every part of sport that one has to do with nature." "How exquisite this steely water is," said Sergei Ivanovitch. "These riverside banks always remind me of the riddle. Do you know it? The grass says to the water, 'We sway and we sway.'"
"I don't know the riddle," answered Levin wearily. Chapter 3
"Do you know, I've been thinking about you," said Sergei Ivanovitch. "It's disgraceful what's being done in the district, according to what this doctor tells me. He's a very intelligent fellow. And as I've told you before, I tell you again, it's not right for you not to go to the meeting, and in general to keep out of the district business. If decent people won't go into it, of course it's bound to go all wrong. We pay the money, and it all goes in salaries, and there are no schools, or male nurses, or midwives, or pharmacies. Nothing.
Well, I did try, you know, Levin said slowly and unwillingly. I can't, and so that's all there is to it.
But why can't you? I must admit I can't understand. Indifference, incapacity, I won't admit. Surely it's not simply laziness.
None of those things. I've tried, and I see I can do nothing, said Levin. He had hardly grasped what his brother was saying. Looking toward the ploughland across the river, he made out something black, but he couldn't distinguish whether it was only a horse or the bailiff on horseback.
"Why is it you can do nothing? You made an attempt and didn't succeed, so you think, and you give in. How can you have so little self-respect?"
"Self-respect?" said Levin, stung to the quick by his brother's words.
"I don't understand. If they told me at college that other people understood the integral calculus and I didn't, then pride would have come in. But in this case, one wants first to be convinced that one has certain qualifications for this sort of business, and especially that all this business is of great importance."
"What? Do you mean to say it's not of importance?" said Sergei Ivanovitch, stung to the quick, too, at his brother's considering anything of no importance that interested him, and still more at his obviously paying little attention to what he was saying.
"I don't think it important. It doesn't excite me. I can't help it," answered Levin, making out that what he saw was the bailiff, and that the bailiff seemed to be taking the peasants off the ploughing. They were turning the plough over.
"Can they have finished ploughing?" he wondered.
"Come, really," said the elder brother, with a frown on his handsome, intelligent face. "There's a limit to everything. It's all right to be eccentric, to be sincere, and to dislike hypocrisy. I know all about that. But really, what you're saying either has no meaning, or it has a very wrong meaning. How can you think it a matter of no importance whether the peasant whom you love, as you assert—"
"I never did assert it," thought Konstantin Levin.
"Dies without help. The ignorant midwives let the infants die, and the people stagnate in darkness and are helpless in the hands of every village clerk, while you have at your disposal a means of helping them, and don't help them because to your mind it's of no importance."
And Sergei Ivanovitch put before him the alternative.
"Either you are so backward that you can't see all that you can do, or you won't sacrifice your comfort, your vanity, or whatever it is, to do it."
Konstantin Levin felt that there was no course open to him but to submit, or to confess to a lack of zeal for the public good, and this mortified him and hurt his feelings.
"It's both," he said resolutely. "I don't see that it was possible."
"What? Was it impossible if the money was put up to provide medical aid?"
"Impossible, as it seems to me. For the 3,000 square miles of our district, what with our thaws and the storms and the work in the fields, I don't see how it is possible to provide medical aid all over. And besides, I don't believe in medicine."
"Oh, well, that's unfair. I can quote to you thousands of instances. But the schools, anyway."
"Why have schools?"
"What do you mean? Can there be two opinions of the advantage of education? If it's a good thing for you, it's a good thing for everyone."
Konstantin Levin felt himself morally pinned against a wall, and so he got excited and unconsciously blurted out the chief cause of his indifference to social issues.
"Perhaps it may all be very good, but why should I worry myself about establishing dispensaries which I shall never make use of, and schools to which I shall never send my children, to which even the peasants don't want to send their children, and to which I've no very firm faith that they ought to send them," said he.
Sergei Ivanovitch was for a minute surprised at this unexpected view of the subject, but he promptly made a new plan of attack. He was silent for a while, drew out a hook, threw it in again, and turned to his brother, smiling.
"Come now. In the first place, the dispensary is needed. We ourselves sent for the district doctor for Agafia Mikhailovna." "Oh, well, but I think her wrist will never be straight again anyway." "That remains to be proved. Next,
The peasant who can read and write is, as a workman, of more use and value to you.
No, you can ask anyone you like, Konstantin Levin answered with decision.
The man that can read and write is much inferior as a workman, and mending the roads is an impossibility, and as soon as they put up bridges, they're stolen.
Still, that's not the point, said Sergei Ivanovich, frowning.
He disliked contradiction, and still more, arguments that were continually skipping from one thing to another, introducing new and disconnected points, so that there was no knowing to which to reply.
Do you admit that education is a benefit for the people?
Yes, I admit it, said Levin without thinking, and he was conscious immediately that he had said what he didn't think. He felt that if he admitted that, it would be proved that he had been talking meaningless rubbish. How it would be proved he couldn't tell, but he knew that this would inevitably be logically proved to him, and he awaited that proof. The argument turned out to be far simpler than he had expected.
If you admit that it is a benefit, said Sergei Ivanovich, then as an honest man you cannot help caring about it and sympathizing with the movement, and so wishing to work for it.
But I still do not admit this movement to be just, said Konstantin Levin, reddening a little.
What? But you said just now, that's to say,
I don't admit its being either good or possible.
That you can't tell without trying it.
Well, supposing that's so, said Levin, though he didn't suppose so at all. Supposing that is so, still, I don't see, all the same, what I'm to worry myself about it for.
How so?
No, since we are talking, explain it to me from the philosophical point of view, said Levin.
I can't see where philosophy comes in, said Sergei Ivanovich, in a tone, Levin thought, as though he didn't admit his brother's right to talk about philosophy.
And that irritated Levin. But he felt at the same instant that what he wanted to say was unintelligible to his brother. Only he couldn't make up his mind whether it was unintelligible because he was not capable of expressing his meaning clearly, or because his brother would not or could not understand him. But he didn't pursue the speculation, and without replying, he began musing on a quite different and personal matter. Sergei Ivanovich wound in the last line, untied the horse, and they drove off. Chapter 4. The personal matter that absorbed Levin during his conversation with his brother was this. The previous year he had once gone to look at the mowing, and being made very angry by the bailiff, he had recourse to his favourite means for regaining his temper. He took a scythe from a peasant and began mowing. He liked the work so much that he had several times tried his hand at mowing since. He had cut all of the meadow in front of his house, and this year, ever since the early spring, he had cherished a plan for mowing for whole days with the peasants. Ever since his brother's arrival, he had been in doubt whether to mow or not. He was loath to leave his brother alone all day long, and he was afraid his brother would laugh at him about it. But as he drove into the meadow and recalled the sensations of mowing, he came near deciding that he would go mowing. After the irritating discussion with his brother, he pondered over this intention again. "I must have physical exercise, or my temper'll certainly be ruined," he thought. And he determined he would go mowing, however awkward he might feel about it with his brother or the peasants. Toward evening, Konstantin Levin went to his office, gave directions about the work to be done, and sent to the village to summon the mowers for the next day to cut the hay in Kalinov Meadow, the largest and best of his grasslands.
"And send my scythe, please, to Titus, for him to set it and bring it around tomorrow. Perhaps I shall do some mowing myself, too," he said, trying not to be embarrassed. The bailiff smiled and said, "Yes, sir."
At tea, the same evening, Levin said to his brother,
"I think the fine weather will last. Tomorrow I shall start mowing." "I like that form of field labour," said Sergei Ivanovich.
"I like it.
I sometimes mow myself with the peasants, and tomorrow I want to try mowing the whole day."
Sergei Ivanovich lifted his head and looked with interest at his brother.
"How do you mean? Just like one of the peasants all day long?"
"Yes, it's very pleasant," said Levin.
"It's splendid as exercise, "'Only you'll hardly be able to stand it,'
said Sergei Ivanovitch, without a shade of irony. "'I've tried it. It's hard work at first, but you get used to it. I think I'll manage to keep up.'
"'Really? What an idea! But tell me, how do the peasants look at it? I suppose they laugh in their sleeves at their masters being such a strange fish?'
"'No, I don't think so.
But it's so delightful, and at the same time such hard work.' "'That one has no time to think about it. "'But what will you do about eating with them? "'To send you a bottle of Chateau Lafitte and roast turkey out there "'would be a little awkward.
"'No, I'll simply come home at the time of their noonday rest.' "'Next morning, Konstantin Levin got up earlier than usual, "'but he was detained giving directions on the farm, "'and when he reached the meadow, "'the mowers were already at their second row.' From the uplands he could get a view of the shaded cut part of the meadow below, with its greyish ridges of cut grass, and the black heaps of coats taken off by the mowers at the place from which they had started cutting. Gradually, as he rode toward the meadow, the peasants came into sight, some in coats, some in their shirts, mowing, one behind another, in a long string, swinging their scythes differently. He counted 42 of them. They were moving slowly over the uneven bottom of the meadow where there had been an old dam. Levin recognized some of his own men. Here was old Yermil, in a very long white smock, bending forward to swing a scythe. There was a young fellow, Vaska, who had been a coachman of Levin's, taking every row with a wide sweep. Here, too, was Titus, Levin's teacher in the art of mowing, a thin little peasant. He was in front of everyone and cut his wide row without bending, as though playing with the scythe. Levin got off his mare, and fastening her by the roadside, went to meet Titus, who took a second scythe out of a bush and gave it to him.
"'It's ready, sir. It's like a razor. Cuts by itself,' said Titus, taking off his cap with a smile and giving him the scythe.
Levin took the scythe and began trying it. As they finished their rows, the mowers, sweating and cheerful, came out into the road one after another, and, laughing a little, greeted the master. They all stared at him, but no one made any remark till a tall old man with a wrinkled, beardless face, wearing a short sheepskin jacket, came out into the road and accosted him.
"'Looky now, master. Once take hold of the rope, there's no letting it go,' he said.
And Levin heard smothered laughter among the mowers.
"'I'll try not to let it go,' he said, taking his stand behind Titus, and waiting for the time to begin. "'Mindy,' repeated the old man.
Titus made room, and Levin started behind him. The grass was short close to the road, and Levin, who hadn't done any mowing for a long time, and was disconcerted by the eyes fastened upon him, cut badly for the first moments, though he swung his scythe vigorously. Behind him he heard voices.
"'It's not set right. Handle's too high. See how he has to stoop to it,' said one. "'Press more on the heel,' said another. "'Never mind. He'll get on all right,' the old man resumed. "'Look, he's made a start. You swing it too wide and you'll tire yourself out. The master sure does his best for himself, but see the grass missed. For such work us fellows would catch it.'
The grass became softer, and Levin, listening without answering, followed Titus, trying to do the best he could. They moved 100 paces. Titus kept moving on without stopping, not showing the slightest weariness. But Levin was already beginning to be afraid he wouldn't be able to keep it up. He was so tired. He felt as he swung his scythe that he was at the very end of his strength, and was making up his mind to ask Titus to stop. But at that very moment, Titus stopped of his own accord, and stooping down, picked up some grass, rubbed his scythe, and began whetting it. Levin straightened himself, and drawing a deep breath, looked around. Behind him came a peasant, and he too was evidently tired, for he stopped at once without waiting to mow up to Levin, and began whetting his scythe. Titus sharpened his scythe and Levin's, and they went on. The next time it was just the same. Titus moved on with sweep after sweep of his scythe, not stopping or showing signs of weariness. Levin followed him, trying not to get left behind, and he found it harder and harder. The moment came when he felt he had no strength left, but at that very moment Titus stopped again and whetted the scythes. So they mowed the first row, and this long row seemed particularly hard work to Levin. But when the end was reached and Titus, shouldering his scythe, began with deliberate stride, returning on the tracks left by his heels in the cut grass, and Levin walked back in the same way over the space he had cut, in spite of the sweat that ran in streams over his face and fell in drops down his nose and drenched his back as though he had been soaked in water, he felt very happy. What delighted him particularly was that now he knew he would be able to hold out. His pleasure was disturbed only by his row not being well cut. "I will swing less with my arm and more with my whole body," he thought, comparing Titus's row, which looked as if it had been cut with a line, with his own unevenly and irregularly scattered grass. The first row, as Levin noticed, Titus had mowed specially quickly, probably wishing to put his master to the test, and the row happened to be a long one. The next rows were easier, but still Levin had to strain every nerve not to drop behind the peasants. He thought of nothing, wished for nothing, but not to be left behind the peasants, and to do his work as well as possible. He heard nothing but the swish of scythes, and saw before him Titus's upright figure mowing away, the crescent-shaped curve of the cut grass, the grass and flower head slowly and rhythmically falling before the blade of his scythe, and ahead of him the end of the row where the rest would come. Suddenly, in the midst of his toil, without understanding what it was or whence it came, he felt a pleasant sensation of chill on his hot, moist shoulders. He glanced at the sky during the interval for wetting the scythes. A heavy, lowering storm cloud had blown up, and big raindrops were falling. Some of the peasants went to their coats and put them on. Others, like Levin, merely shrugged their shoulders, enjoying the pleasant coolness of it. Another row, and yet another row followed, long rows and short rows, with good grass and with poor grass. Levin lost all sense of time, and couldn't have told whether it was late or early now. A change began to come over his work, which gave him immense satisfaction. In the midst of his toil, there were moments during which he forgot what he was doing, and it came easy to him, and at those same moments his row was almost as smooth and well cut as Titus's. But as soon as he recollected what he was doing and began trying to do better, he was at once conscious of the difficulty of his task, and the row was badly mown. On finishing yet another row, he would have gone back to the top of the meadow again to begin the next, but Titus stopped, and going up to the old man, said something in a low voice to him. They both looked at the sun. "What are they talking about, and why doesn't he go back?" thought Levin, not guessing that the peasants had been mowing no less than 4 hours without stopping, and it was time for their lunch.
"Lunch, sir," said the old man. "Is it really time? That's right, lunch, then."
Levin gave his scythe to Titus, and together with the peasants who were crossing the long stretch of mown grass, slightly sprinkled with rain, to get their bread from the heap of coats, he went toward his house. Only then did he suddenly awake to the fact that he had been wrong about the weather, and the rain was drenching his hay. "The hay will be spoiled," he said.
"No, it won't be, sir. Mow in the rain and you'll rake in fine weather," said the old man.
Levin untied his horse and rode home to his coffee. Sergei Ivanovich was just getting up. When he had drunk his coffee, Levin rode back again to the mowing before Sergei Ivanovich had had time to dress and come down to the dining room. Chapter 5. After lunch, Levin was not in the same place in the string of mowers as before, but stood between the old man, who had accosted him humorously, and now invited him to be his neighbour, and a young peasant, who had just been married in the autumn, and who was mowing this summer for the first time. The old man, holding himself erect, moved in front, with his feet turned out, taking long, regular strides, and with a precise and regular action which seemed to cost him no more effort than swinging one's arms in walking, as though it were in play, he laid the grass in the high, even rows. It was as though it was not he, but the sharp scythe itself that was swishing through the juicy grass. Behind Levin came the lad Mishka. His pleasant boyish face, with a twist of fresh grass bound around his hair, was contorted with effort, but whenever anyone looked at him, he smiled. He would clearly have died sooner than admit it was hard work for him. Levin kept between them. In the very heat of the day, the mowing didn't seem such hard work to him. The perspiration with which he was drenched cooled him, while the sun that burned his back, his head, and his arms bare to the elbow gave vigour and increased his perseverance to his labour. And more often now came those moments of unconsciousness when it was possible not to think of what one was doing. The scythe cut by itself. These were happy moments. Still more delightful were the moments when they reached the stream where the rose ended, and the old man rubbed his scythe with the wet, thick grass, rinsed its blade in the fresh water of the stream, ladled out a little in a tin dipper, and offered Levin a drink.
"What do you say to kvass, eh? Good, eh?" said he, winking.
And truly, Levin had never drunk anything so good as this warm water with bits of grass floating in it, and a taste of rust from the tin dipper. And immediately after this came the delicious slow saunter, with his hand on the scythe, during which he could wipe away the streaming sweat, take deep breaths of air, and look about at the long string of mowers and at what was happening all around in the forest and the country. The longer Levin mowed, the oftener he felt the movements of unconsciousness in which it seemed that the scythe was mowing by itself, a body full of life and consciousness of its own, and as though by magic, without thinking of it, the work turned out regular and precise by itself. These were the most blissful moments. It was hard work only when he had to break off the motion which had become unconscious, and think, when he had to mow around a mound or a tuft of sorrel. The old man did this easily. When a mound came, he changed his action, and at one time with the heel, and at another with the tip of his scythe, he clipped the mound around both sides with short strokes. And while he did this, he kept looking about and watching what came into his view. At one moment he picked up a wild berry and ate it, or offered it to Levin. Then he flung away a twig with a blade of the scythe. Then he looked at a quail's nest, from which the bird flew just under the scythe, or caught a snake that crossed his path, and lifting it on the scythe as though on a fork, showed it to Levin and threw it away. For both Levin and the young peasant behind him, such changes of position were difficult. Both of them, repeating over and over again the same strained movement, were in a perfect frenzy of toil, and were incapable of shifting their position and at the same time watching what was before them. Levin didn't notice how time was passing. If he'd been asked how long he'd been working, he would have said half an hour, and it was getting to be dinner time. As they were walking back over the cut grass, the old man called Levin's attention to the little girls and boys who were coming from different directions, hardly visible through the long grass, and along the road toward the mowers, carrying sacks of bread, dragging their little hands down, and pitchers of kvass, stoppered with rags.
"Looky, the little gnats crawling," he said, pointing to them, and he shaded his eyes with his hand to look at the sun.
They mowed two more rows. The old man stopped.
"Come, sir, dinner time," he said briskly,
and on reaching the stream the mowers moved off across the lines of cut grass toward their pile of coats, where the children who had brought their dinners were sitting waiting for them. The peasants gathered into groups, those further away under a cart, those nearer under a willow bush. Levin sat down by them. He felt he didn't want to go away. All constraint with the master had vanished long ago. The peasants got ready for dinner. Some washed, the young boys bathed in the stream. Others made a place comfortable for a rest, untied their sacks of bread, and unstoppered the pitchers of kvass. The old man crumbled up some bread in a cup, stirred it with the handle of a spoon, poured water on it from the dipper, broke up some more bread, and having seasoned it with salt, turned to the east to say his prayer.
"Come, master, taste my grub," said he, kneeling down before the cup.
The food was so good that Levin gave up the idea of going home. He dined with the old man, and talked to him about his family affairs, taking the keenest interest in them, and told him about his own affairs, and all the circumstances that could be of interest to the old man. He felt much closer to him than to his brother, and couldn't help smiling at the affection he felt for this man. When the old man got up again, said his prayer, and lay down under a bush, putting some grass under his head for a pillow, Levin did the same, and in spite of the clinging flies that were so persistent in the sunshine, and the gnats that tickled his sweating face and body, he fell asleep at once, and waked only when the sun had passed to the other side of the bush and reached him. The old man had been awake a long while, and was sitting up, wetting the sighs of the younger boys. Levin looked about him, and hardly recognized the place. Everything was so changed. The immense stretch of meadow had been mown, and was sparkling with a peculiar fresh brilliance, with its lines of already sweet-smelling grass, in the slanting rays of the evening sun. And the bushes about the river had been cut down, and the river itself, not visible before, now gleaming like steel in its bends, and the moving, ascending peasants, and the sharp wall of grass of the unmown part of the meadow, and the hawks hovering over the stripped meadow, all was perfectly new. Raising himself, Levin began considering how much had been cut, and how much more could still be done that day. The 42 men had done a considerable amount. They had cut the whole of the big meadow, which had, in the years of serf labour, taken 30 scythes 2 days to mow. Only the corners remained to be done, where the rows were short. But Levin felt a longing to get as much mowing done that day as possible, and was vexed with the sun sinking so quickly in the sky. He felt no weariness. All he wanted was to get his work done more and more quickly, and as much done as possible. "Could we cut Mashkin Upland too? What do you think?" he said to the old man.
"As God wills. The sun's not high. A little vodka for the boys."
At the afternoon rest, when they were sitting down again, and those who smoked had lighted their pipes, the old man told the men,
"Mashkin Upland's to be cut. There'll be some vodka. Why not cut it? Come on, Titus, we'll do it quickly. You can eat at night. Come on!"
cried voices, and finishing their bread, the mowers went back to work.
"Come, boys, keep it up," said Titus, and ran on ahead almost at a trot. "Go on, go on!" said the old man, hurrying after him and easily overtaking him. "I'll mow you down. Look out!"
And young and old mowed away, as though they were racing with one another. But however quickly they worked, they didn't spoil the grass, and the rows were laid just as neatly and exactly. The little piece left uncut in the corner was mown in 5 minutes. The last of the mowers were just ending their rows, while the foremost snatched up their coats and slung them over their shoulders and crossed the road toward Mashkin Upland. The sun was already sinking into the trees when they went, with their tin boxes rattling, into the wooded ravine of Mashkin Upland. The grass was up to their waists in the middle of the hollow, soft, tender, and broad-bladed, spotted here and there among the trees with wild pansies. After a brief consultation, whether to take the rows lengthwise or diagonally, Prokhor Yermilin, also a renowned mower, a huge black-haired peasant, went on ahead. He went up to the top, turned back again, and started mowing, and they all proceeded to form in line behind him, going downhill through the hollow and uphill right up to the edge of the forest. The sun sank behind the forest. The dew was falling by now. The mowers were in the sun only on the hillside, but below, where a mist was rising, and on the opposite side, they mowed into the fresh, dewy shade. The work went rapidly. The grass cut with a juicy sound, and was at once laid in high, fragrant rows. The mowers, from all sides, brought closer together in the short row, kept urging one another on to the sound of rattling tin boxes and clanging scythes, and the hiss of the whetstone sharpening them, and happy shouts. Levin still kept between the young peasant and the old man. The old man, who had put on his short sheepskin jacket, was just as merry, jocose, and free in his movements. Among the trees they were continually cutting with their scythes the birch mushrooms swollen fat in the succulent grass. But the old man bent down every time he came across a mushroom, picked it up, and put it under his shirt.
"Another present for my old woman," he said, as he did so.
Easy as it was to mow the wet, soft grass, it was hard work going up and down the steep sides of the ravine. But this didn't trouble the old man. Swinging his scythe just as usual, and moving his feet in their big bast shoes with firm little steps, he climbed slowly up the steep place, and though his breeches were hanging out below his smock, and his whole frame trembled with effort, he didn't miss one blade of grass or one mushroom on his way, and kept making jokes with the peasants and Levin. Levin walked after him, thinking often that he would fall any minute as he climbed with a scythe up a steep cliff where it would have been hard work to climb even without anything. But he climbed up and did what he had to do. He felt as though some external force was moving him. Chapter 6 Mashkin Upland was moon. The last row finished, and the peasants had put on their coats and were gaily trudging home. Levin got on his horse, and parting regretfully from the peasants, he rode homeward. On the hillside he looked back. He couldn't see them in the mist that had risen from the valley. He could only hear rough, merry voices, laughter, and the sound of clanking scythes. Sergei Ivanovitch had long ago finished dinner and was drinking iced lemon and water in his own room, looking through the reviews and papers he had just received by mail, when Levin rushed into the room, talking merrily, with his wet and matted hair sticking to his forehead and his back and chest dark with sweat. "We mowed the whole meadow. Oh, it's nice, delicious. And how have you been getting on?" said Levin, completely forgetting the disagreeable conversation of the previous day. "Good heavens, what you look like!" said Sergei Ivanovitch, for the first moment looking round with some dissatisfaction. "And the door! Shut the door!" he cried. "You must have let in a dozen at least." Sergei Ivanovitch couldn't stand flies, and in his own room he never opened the window except at night, and carefully kept the door shut. "Not one, on my honour. But if I have, I'll catch them. You wouldn't believe what a pleasure it is. How have you spent the day?" "Very well. But have you really been mowing the whole day? You must be as hungry as a wolf. Kuzma has got everything ready for you." "No, I don't even feel hungry. I had something to eat there. But I'll go and wash." "Yes, go along, and I'll come to you right away," said Sergei Ivanovitch, shaking his head as he looked at his brother. "Go along, make haste," he added, smiling. And gathering up his books, he prepared to go too. Suddenly he felt happy too, and disinclined to leave his brother's side.
"But what did you do while it was raining?"
"Rain? Why, there was scarcely a drop. I'll come soon. So you had a nice day too? That's fine." And Levin went off to change his clothes. 5 minutes later, the brothers met in the dining room. Although it seemed to Levin that he wasn't hungry, and he sat down to dinner simply so as not to hurt Kuzma's feelings, when he began to eat, the dinner struck him as extraordinarily good. Sergei Ivanovitch watched him with a smile.
"Oh, by the way, there's a letter for you," he said. "Kuzma, bring it, please. And be careful you shut the doors."
The letter was from Oblonsky. Levin read it aloud. Oblonsky wrote to him from Petersburg.
"I have had a letter from Dolly. She's at Yergusheva, and everything seems to be going wrong there. Ride over and see her, please. Help her with advice. You know all about it. She'll be so glad to see you. She's quite alone, poor thing. My mother-in-law and all of them are still abroad." "Oh, that's splendid. I'll certainly ride over to her," said Levin. "Or we'll go together. She's such a splendid woman, isn't she?" "They're not far from here, then." 25 miles, or perhaps it's 30. But a fine road. Splendid. We'll drive over." "I shall be delighted," said Sergei Ivanovitch, still smiling.
The sight of his younger brother's appearance had immediately put him in a good humour.
"Well, you have an appetite," he said, looking at his dark red sunburned face and neck bent over the plate. "Splendid. You can't imagine what an effectual remedy it is for every sort of foolishness. I want to enrich medicine with a new phrase, work cure." "Well, but you don't need it, I think."
"No, but for all sorts of nervous invalids."
"Yes, it ought to be tried. I had meant to come to the mowing to watch you, but it was so unbearably hot that I got no further than the forest. I sat there a little, and went on by the forest to the village, met your old nurse, and sounded her out as to the peasant's view of you. As far as I can make out, they don't approve of this. She said,
It's not a gentleman's work. All in all, I think that in the people's ideas there are very clear and definite notions of certain, as they call it, gentlemanly lines of action. And they don't sanction the gentry's moving outside bounds clearly laid down in their ideas.
Perhaps. But anyway, it's a pleasure such as I've never known in my life.
And there's no harm in it, you know, is there?
Levin answered.
I can't help it if they don't like it. Besides, I think it's all right, eh?
On the whole, Sergei Ivanovitch pursued, you're satisfied with your day?
Quite satisfied. We cut the whole meadow.
And such a splendid old man I made friends with there. You can't imagine how delightful he was.
Well, so you're content with your day,
and so am I.
First I solved two chess problems, and one a real beauty, a pawn opening. I'll show it to you. And then I thought over our conversation yesterday.
Oh, our conversation yesterday, said Levin, blissfully dropping his eyelids and drawing deep breaths after finishing his dinner, and absolutely incapable of recalling what their conversation yesterday was about.
I think you're partly right. Our difference of opinion amounts to this, that you make the mainspring self-interest, while I suppose that interest in the common good is bound to exist in every man of a certain degree of advancement. Possibly you are right, too, that action founded on material interest would be more desirable. You are altogether, as the French say, tout prime sautier a nature. You must have intense, energetic action or nothing.
Levin listened to his brother and didn't understand a single word, and didn't want to understand. He was only afraid his brother might ask him some question that would make it evident that he hadn't heard.
So, that's what I think it is, my dear boy, said Sergei Ivanovitch, touching him on the shoulder.
Yes, of course. But do you know, I won't stand up for my view, Levin answered with a guilty, childlike smile.
What was it I was disputing about? He wondered.
Of course, I'm right, and he's right, and it's all right. But I must get to the office and see to things.
He got up, stretching and smiling. Sergei Ivanovitch smiled too.
If you want to go out, let's go together, he said,
not wanting to be parted from his brother, who seemed to be positively exuding freshness and energy.
Come, we'll go to the office if you have to go there.
Oh, heavens! Shouted Levin so loudly that Sergei Ivanovitch was quite frightened.
What's the matter?
How is Agafia Mikhailovna's hand? Said Levin, slapping himself on the head. I'd positively forgotten all about her.
It's much better.
Well, anyway, I'll run down to her. Before you've time to get your hat on, I'll be back. And he ran downstairs, clattering his heels like a rattle. Chapter 7 Stepan Arkadyevitch had gone to Petersburg to perform the most natural and essential official duty, so familiar to everyone in the government service, though incomprehensible to outsiders. That duty, but for which one could hardly be in government service, of reminding the ministry of his existence, and having, for the due performance of this rite, taken all the available cash from home, he was happily spending his days at the races and in the summer villas. Meanwhile, Dolly and the children had moved to the country to cut down expenses as much as possible. She had gone to Yogushova, the estate that had been her dowry, and the one where, in spring, the forest had been sold. It was nearly 40 miles from Levin's Pokrovskoye. The big old house at Yogushova had been pulled down long ago, and the old prince had had the lodge done up and enlarged. 20 years before, when Dolly was a child, the lodge had been roomy and comfortable, though, like all lodges, it stood sideways to the drive and faced south. But by now, this lodge was old and dilapidated. When Stepan Arkadyevitch had gone down in the spring to sell the forest, Dolly had begged him to look over the house and order what repairs might be needed. Stepan Arkadyevitch, like all unfaithful husbands, was very solicitous for his wife's comfort, and he himself had looked over the house and given instructions about everything that he considered necessary. What he considered necessary was to cover all the furniture with cretonne, to put up curtains, to weed the garden, to make a little bridge on the pond, and to plant flowers. but he forgot many other essential matters, the want of which greatly distressed Darya Alexandrovna later on. In spite of Stepan Arkadyevitch's efforts to be an attentive father and husband, he never could keep in his mind that he had a wife and children. He had bachelor tastes, and it was in accordance with them that he shaped his life. On his return to Moscow, he informed his wife with pride that everything was ready, that the house would be a little paradise, and that he advised her most certainly to go. His wife's staying away in the country was very agreeable to Stepan Arkadyevitch from every point of view. It did the children good, it decreased expenses, and it left him more at liberty. Darya Alexandrovna regarded staying in the country for the summer as essential for the children, especially for the little girl, who had not succeeded in regaining her strength after the scarlet fever, and also as a means of escaping the petty humiliations, the small bills owing to the wood merchant, the fishmonger, the shoemaker, which made her miserable. Besides this, she was pleased to go away to the country, because she was dreaming of getting her sister Kitty to stay with her there. Kitty was to be back from abroad in the middle of the summer, and bathing had been prescribed for her. Kitty wrote that no prospect was so alluring as to spend the summer with Dolly at Yogushova, full of childhood memories for both of them. The first days of her existence in the country were very hard for Dolly. She used to stay in the country as a child, and the impression she had retained of it was that the country was a refuge from all the unpleasantness of the town, that life there, though not luxurious, Dolly could easily make up her mind to that, was cheap and comfortable, that there was plenty of everything. Everything was cheap, everything could be got, and children were happy. But now, coming to the country as head of a family, she perceived that it was all utterly unlike what she had expected. The day after their arrival there was a heavy fall of rain, and in the night the water came through in the hall and in the nursery, so that the beds had to be carried into the drawing-room. There was no kitchen-maid to be found. Of the 9 cows, it appeared from the words of the dairy-maids, that some were about to calve, others had just calved, others were old, and others were hard-uddered. There was not milk or butter enough even for the children. There were no eggs. They could get no fowls. Old, purplish, tough cocks were all they had for roasting and boiling. Impossible to get women to scrub the floors. All were potato-hoeing. Driving was out of the question, because one of the horses was restive and bolted in the shafts. There was no place where they could bathe. The whole of the river bank was trampled by the cattle and open to the road. Even walks were impossible, for the cattle strayed into the garden through a gap in the hedge, and there was one terrible bull who bellowed and therefore might be expected to gore somebody. There were no proper cupboards for their clothes. What cupboards there were either wouldn't close at all or burst open whenever anyone passed by them. There were no pots and pans. There was no copper in the wash-house, not even an ironing-board in the maid's room. Finding, instead of peace and rest, all these, from her point of view, fearful calamities, Darya Alexandrovna was at first in despair. She exerted herself to the utmost, felt the hopelessness of the situation, and was every instant suppressing the tears that started into her eyes. The bailiff, a retired quartermaster whom Stepan Arkadyevitch had taken a fancy to, and had appointed bailiff on account of his handsome and respectful appearance, showed no sympathy for Darya Alexandrovna's woes. He said respectfully, "Nothing can be done. The peasants are such a wretched bunch," and did nothing to help her. The situation seemed hopeless. But in the Oblonsky's household, as in all families indeed, there was one inconspicuous but most valuable and useful person, Matryona Filimonovna. She soothed her mistress, assured her that everything would work out. It was her expression, and Matvei had borrowed it from her, and without fuss or hurry proceeded to set to work herself. She had immediately made friends with the bailiff's wife, and on the very first day she drank tea with her and the bailiff under the acacias, and reviewed all the circumstances of the situation. Very soon, Matryona Filimonovna had established her club, so to say, under the acacias, and there it was, in this club, consisting of the bailiff's wife, the village elder, and the office clerk, that the difficulties of existence were gradually smoothed away, and in a week's time everything actually had worked out. The roof was mended, A cook was found, a crony of the village elders. Hens were brought. The cows began giving milk. The garden hedge was stopped up with stakes. The carpenter made a mangle. Hooks were put in the cupboards, and they ceased to burst open spontaneously. And an ironing board covered with army cloth was placed across from the arm of a chair to the chest of drawers, and there was a smell of flat irons in the maid's room.
"Just see now, and you were in despair," said Matryona Filimonovna, pointing to the ironing board.
They even rigged up a bathing shed of straw hurdles. Lily began to bathe, and Darya Alexandrovna began to realize, if only in part, her expectations, if not of a peaceful, at least of a comfortable life in the country. Peaceful with six children, Darya Alexandrovna could not be. One would fall ill, another might easily become so, a third would be without something necessary, a fourth would show symptoms of a bad disposition, and so on. Rare indeed were the brief periods of peace. But these cares and anxieties were, for Darya Alexandrovna, the sole happiness possible. Had it not been for them, she would have been left alone to brood over her husband, who didn't love her. And besides, hard though it was for the mother to bear the dread of illness, the illnesses themselves, and the grief of seeing signs of evil propensities in her children, the children themselves were even now repaying her in small joys for her sufferings. Those joys were so small that they passed unnoticed like gold in sand, and at bad moments she could see nothing but the pain, nothing but sand. But there were good moments, too, when she saw nothing but the joy, nothing but gold. Now, in the solitude of the country, she began to be more and more frequently aware of those joys. Often, looking at them, she would make every possible effort to persuade herself that she was mistaken, that she as a mother was partial to her children. All the same, she couldn't help saying to herself that she had charming children, all six of them in different ways, but children such as are not often to be met, and she was happy in them and proud of them. Chapter 8. Toward the end of May, when everything had been more or less satisfactorily arranged, she received her husband's answer to her complaints of the disorganized state of things in the country. He wrote, begging her forgiveness for not having thought of everything before, and promised to come down at the first chance. This chance did not present itself until the beginning of June. Darya Alexandrovna stayed alone in the country. On Sunday, on St. Peter's Day, Darya Alexandrovna drove to Mass with all her children to take communion. Darya Alexandrovna, in her intimate philosophical talks with her sister, her mother, and her friends, very often astonished them by the freedom of her views in regard to religion. She had a strange religion, all her own, of transmigration of souls, in which she had firm faith, troubling herself little about the dogmas of the Church. But in her family she was strict in carrying out all that was required by the Church, and not merely in order to set an example, but with her whole heart in it. The fact that the children had not been to communion for nearly a year very much worried her, and with the full approval and sympathy of Matryona Filimonovna, she decided that this should take place now, in the summer. For several days before, Darya Alexandrovna was busily deliberating on how to dress all the children. Frocks were made, or altered and washed, seams and flounces were let out, buttons were sewn on, and ribbons got ready. One dress, Tanya's, which the English governess was altering, cost Darya Alexandrovna much loss of temper. The English governess had made the seams in the wrong place, had taken up the sleeves too much, and altogether spoiled the dress. It was so narrow on Tanya's shoulders that it was quite painful to look at her. But Matryona Filimonovna had the happy thought of putting in gussets and adding a little shoulder cape. The dress was fixed, but there was nearly a quarrel with the English governess. Next morning, however, all was happily arranged, and toward 10 o'clock, the time at which they had asked the priest to wait for them for the Mass, the children, in their new dresses, with beaming faces, stood on the step before the carriage waiting for their mother. In the carriage, instead of the restive raven, they had harnessed, thanks to the intercession of Matryona Filimonovna, the bailiff's horse, Brownie, and Darya Alexandrovna, delayed by anxiety over her own attire, came out and got in, dressed in a white muslin gown.
Darya Alexandrovna had done her hair and dressed with care and excitement. In the old days she had dressed for her own sake to look pretty and be admired. Later on, as she got older, dressing up became more and more distasteful to her. She saw that she was losing her good looks. But now she began to feel pleasure and interest in dressing up again. Now she didn't dress for her own sake, not for the sake of her own beauty, but simply so that as the mother of those exquisite creatures she might not spoil the general effect. And looking at herself for the last time in the mirror, she was satisfied with herself. She looked nice. Not nice as she would have wished to look nice in the old days at a ball, but nice for the object she now had in view. In the church there was no one but the peasants, the servants, and their women. But Darya Alexandrovna saw, or thought she saw, the sensation produced by her children and her. The children were not only beautiful to look at in their smart little dresses, but they were charming in the way they behaved. Aloysia, it is true, didn't stand quite correctly. He kept turning round, trying to look at his little jacket from behind, but all the same he was wonderfully sweet. Tanya behaved like a grown-up person, and looked after the little ones. And the smallest, Lily, was bewitching in her naive astonishment at everything. And it was difficult not to smile when, after taking the sacrament, she said in English, "Please, some more?" On the way home, the children felt that something solemn had happened and were very subdued. Everything went happily at home, too. But at lunch, Grisha began whistling, and what was worse, was disobedient to the English governess and was forbidden to have any pie. Darya Alexandrovna would not have let things go so far on such a day had she been present, but she had to support the English governess's authority, and she upheld her decision that Grisha should have no pie. This rather spoiled the general happiness. Grisha cried, declaring that Nikolinka had whistled too, and he wasn't punished, and that he wasn't crying for the pie, he didn't care, but at being unjustly treated. This was really too tragic, and Darya Alexandrovna made up her mind to persuade the English governess to forgive Grisha, and she went to speak to her. But on her way, as she passed the drawing-room, she beheld a scene that filled her heart with such pleasure that tears came into her eyes, and she forgave the delinquent herself. The culprit was sitting at the window in the corner of the drawing-room. Beside him was standing Tanya with a plate. On the pretext of wanting to give some dinner to her dolls, she had asked the governess's permission to take her share of pie to the nursery, and had taken it instead to her brother. While still weeping over the injustice of his punishment, he was eating the pie, and kept saying through his sobs, "Eat yourself. Let's eat it together. Together." Tanya had at first been under the influence of her pity for Grisha, then of a sense of her noble action, and tears were standing in her eyes too, but she didn't refuse, and ate her share. On catching sight of their mother they were dismayed, but looking into her face they saw that they were not doing wrong. They burst out laughing, and with their mouths full of pie they began wiping their smiling lips with their hands and smearing their radiant faces all over with tears and jam. "Heavens, your new white frock! Tanya, Grisha!" said their mother, trying to save the frock, but with tears in her eyes, smiling a blissful, rapturous smile. The new frocks were taken off, and orders were given for the little girls to have their blouses put on, and the boys their old jackets, and the trap to be harnessed with Brownie, to the bailiff's annoyance, again in the shafts, to drive out for mushroom-picking and bathing. A roar of delighted shrieks arose in the nursery, and never ceased till they had set off for the bathing-place. They gathered a whole basketful of mushrooms. Even Lily found a birch mushroom. It had always happened before that Miss Hull found them and pointed them out to her, but this time she found a big one all by herself, and there was a general scream of delight. "Lily has found a mushroom!" Then they reached the river, put the horses under the birch trees, and went to the bathing-place. The coachman, Terenti, tied the horses, who kept whisking away the flies, to a tree, and treading down the grass, lay down in the shade of a birch and smoked his shag, while the never-ceasing shrieks of delight from the children floated across to him from the bathing-place.
Though it was hard work to look after all the children and restrain their wild pranks, though it was difficult, too, to keep in one's head and not mix up all the stockings, little breeches and shoes for the different legs, and to undo and do up again all the tapes and buttons, Darya Alexandrovna, who had always liked bathing herself and believed it to be very good for the children, enjoyed nothing so much as bathing with all the children. To go over all those fat little legs, pulling on their stockings, to take in her arms and dip those little naked bodies, and to hear their screams of delight and alarm, to see breathless faces with wide-open, scared, and happy eyes of all her splashing cherubs, was a great pleasure to her. When half the children had been dressed, some peasant women, in holiday dress, out picking herbs, came up to the bathing shed and stopped shyly. Matryona Filimonovna called one of them and handed her a sheet and a shirt that had dropped into the water for her to dry them, and Darya Alexandrovna began to talk to the women. At first they laughed behind their hands and didn't understand her questions, but soon they grew bolder and began to talk, winning Darya Alexandrovna's heart at once by the genuine admiration of the children that they showed.
"My, what a beauty! As white as sugar," said one, admiring Tanichka and shaking her head. "But thin?"
"Yes, she's been ill."
"And so they've been bathing you, too?" said another to the baby.
"No,
he's only 3 months old," answered Darya Alexandrovna with pride.
"You don't say so!
And have you any children?"
"I've had 4. I've 2 living, a boy and a girl. I weaned her before Lent."
"How old is she?"
"Why, 2 years."
"Why did you nurse her so long?"
"It's our custom, for 3 fasts.
And the conversation became most interesting to Darya Alexandrovna. What sort of a time did she have? What was the matter with the boy? Where was her husband? Did it often happen? Darya Alexandrovna felt disinclined to leave the peasant women, so interesting to her was their conversation, so completely identical were all their interests. What pleased her most of all was that she saw clearly what all the women admired more than anything was her having so many children, and such fine ones. The peasant women even made Darya Alexandrovna laugh, and offended the English governess, because she was the cause of the laughter she didn't understand. One of the younger women kept staring at the Englishwoman, who was dressing after all the rest, and when she put on her 3rd petticoat, she couldn't refrain from the remark,
"My, she keeps putting on, and she'll never put enough on."
And they all went off into roars. Chapter 9. On the drive home, as Darya Alexandrovna, with all her children around her, their heads still wet from their bath, and a kerchief tied over her own head, was getting near the house, the coachman said,
"There's some gentleman coming. The master of Pokrovskoye, I do believe."
Darya Alexandrovna peeped out in front and was delighted when she recognised in the grey hat and grey coat the familiar figure of Levin walking to meet them. She was glad to see him at any time, but at this moment she was specially glad he should see her in all her glory. No one was better able to appreciate her grandeur than Levin. Seeing her, he found himself face to face with one of the pictures of family life his imagination painted.
"You're like a hen with your chickens, Darya Alexandrovna."
"Oh, how glad I am to see you," she said, holding out her hand to him.
"Glad to see me, but you didn't let me know. My brother's staying with me. I got a note from Stiva that you were here."
"From Stiva?" Darya Alexandrovna asked with surprise.
"Yes. He writes that you are here, and he thinks you might allow me to be of use to you," said Levin.
And as he said it, he became suddenly embarrassed, and stopping abruptly, he walked on in silence by the trap, snapping off the buds of the lime trees and nibbling them. He was embarrassed through a sense that Darya Alexandrovna would be annoyed by receiving from an outsider help that should by rights have come from her own husband. Darya Alexandrovna certainly did not like this little way of Stepan Arkadyevitch's of foisting his domestic duties on others, and she was at once aware that Levin was aware of this. It was just for the fineness of perception, for this delicacy, that Darya Alexandrovna liked Levin.
I know, of course, said Levin, that that simply means that you would like to see me, and I'm exceedingly glad. Though I can imagine that, used to town housekeeping as you are, you must feel in the wilds here, and if there's anything needed, I'm altogether at your disposal.
Oh, no, said Dolly. At first things were rather uncomfortable, but now we've settled everything wonderfully, thanks to my old nurse, she said, indicating Matryona Filimonovna, who, seeing that they were speaking of her, smiled brightly and cordially to Levin. She knew him, and knew that he would be a good match for the young lady, and was very keen to see the matter settled.
"Won't you get in, sir? We'll make room this side," she said to him.
"No, I'll walk. Children, who'd like to race the horses with me?"
The children knew Levin very little, and couldn't remember when they had seen him, but they experienced none of that strange feeling of shyness and hostility toward him which children so often experience towards hypocritical grown-up people, and for which they are so often and miserably punished. Hypocrisy in anything whatever may deceive the cleverest and most penetrating man, but the least wide-awake of children recognizes it and is revolted by it, however ingeniously it may be disguised. Whatever faults Levin had, there was not a trace of hypocrisy in him, and so the children showed him the same friendliness that they saw in their mother's face. On his invitation, the two elder ones at once jumped out to him and ran with him as simply as they would have done with their nurse or Miss Hull or their mother. Lily, too, began begging to go to him, and her mother handed her to him. He sat her on his shoulder and ran along with her.
"Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, Darya Alexandrovna," he said, smiling brightly to the mother. "There's no chance of my hurting or dropping her."
And looking at his strong, agile, very careful and needlessly wary movements, the mother felt her mind at rest and smiled gaily and approvingly as she watched him. Here, in the country, with children, and with Darya Alexandrovna, with whom he was in sympathy, Levin was in a mood not infrequent with him of childlike light-heartedness, which she particularly liked in him. As he ran with the children, he taught them gymnastic feats, started Miss Hull laughing with his peculiar English accent, and talked to Darya Alexandrovna of his pursuits in the country. After dinner, Darya Alexandrovna, sitting alone with him on the balcony, began to speak of Kitty.
"You know, Kitty's coming here, and is going to spend the summer with me."
"Really?" he said, flushing, and at once, to change the conversation, he said, "Then shall I send you 2 cows? If you insist on a bill, you shall pay me 5 roubles a month. But it's not nice of you."
"No, thank you. We can manage very well now."
"Oh, well then, I'll have a look at your cows, and if you'll allow me, I'll give directions about their food. Everything depends on their food."
And Levin, to keep the conversation here, explained to Darya Alexandrovna the theory of dairy farming based on the principle that the cow is simply a machine for the transformation of food into milk, and so on. He talked of this, and passionately longed to hear more of Kitty, and at the same time was afraid of hearing it. He dreaded the breaking up of the inward peace he had gained with such effort.
"Yes, but still all this has to be looked after, and who is there to look after it?" Darya Alexandrovna responded without interest.
She had by now got her household matters so satisfactorily arranged, thanks to Matryona Filimonovna, that she was disinclined to make any change in them. Besides, she had no faith in Levin's knowledge of farming. General principles, as to the cow being a machine for the production of milk, she looked on with suspicion. It seemed to her that such principles could be only a hindrance in farm management. It all seemed to her a far simpler matter. All that was needed, as Matryona Filimonovna had explained, was to give Brindle and Whitebelly more food and drink, and not to let the cook carry all the kitchen slops to the laundress's cow. That was clear. But general propositions as to feeding on meal and on grass were doubtful and obscure. And, what was most important, she wanted to talk about Kitty.